Today is Tuesday, October 20th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Bolivia is set to have a new president.
At the end of the day, it seems that the entire process was done fairly without violence and really showing the strength of these Bolivian institutions.
Also ahead, a new treatment for Ebola.
So it had always been our great hope that we would one day have a therapeutic agent that would provide a benefit to the patient to come to us. So this has been something we've been waiting for a long time.
Plus, protests in Thailand. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Thailand, where youth-led protests have occurred since July. The demonstrations are against the country's monarchy and the government of Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, a general who seized power in a 2014 coup. Chan-o-cha rejects accusations of engineering an election last year to stay in office. On Tuesday, a Thai court ordered the suspension of an online TV station critical of the government, which the government said had violated emergency measures aimed at ending the protests. The government's digital ministry said that Voice TV had also been found to have breached the Computer Crime Act by uploading, quote, false information, end quote. Thailand has drawn criticism from rights groups for banning demonstrations and the publication of news seen as damaging by the government as it tries to end the protests against Prayut and the powerful monarchy. Despite a ban on public gatherings and the arrest of many protest leaders, the protests have swelled in recent days. To share information and help keep each other safe, protesters have developed a set of hand signals to help communicate with each other. Libby Hogan of Reuters has that story.
Pointing above their heads means they need umbrellas. Hands held overhead equals need a helmet. And if both hands are crossed, it means supplies are enough. The Thai protesters have called for Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha to stand down and to curb the powers of the monarchy of King Maha Vajiralongkorn. The demonstrations have continued for 3 months. And while they might appear chaotic, between themselves, protesters have developed a whole new language to coordinate themselves among crowds of thousands.
At first, we have to work out what people are saying, but with gestures, it's pretty easy to guess what they wanted to communicate.
Despite a government ban, the use of water cannon, and arrests of many protest leaders, the protests in Bangkok and across the country have grown in defiance. Like-minded activists from Thailand and Hong Kong have shown mutual support for each other under a Milk Tea Alliance hashtag, referring to drinks popular in both places. Some of the words in the Thai hand signal vocabulary also took their inspiration from protesters in Hong Kong. So for water, this is how we do it. This is the sign for goggles, this is helmet. We also pass down messages by shouting Chinese whispers from the front to the back of the crowd or until it reaches the destination. The rapid train of whispers has been seen in action when protesters have cleared the path for ambulances and formed human chains to pass a steady flow of helmets. On the weekend, the protesters' new language began to really take shape, with groups teaching one another and practicing in huddles. The demonstrations have also become more critical of the monarchy, breaking a long-standing taboo, despite potential jail terms of up to 15 years for anyone insulting the king.
Thanks to Libby Hogan of Reuters for that report. In Bolivia, socialist candidate Luis Arce is set to be the next president after early counts showed he had taken more than 50% of the vote in Sunday's election. Center-right candidate Carlos Mesa, who got around 30% of the vote, conceded the election Monday. If confirmed by the official counts in the coming days, an Arce win brings the mass party of leftist former president Evo Morales back into power. Morales was forced to resign a year ago after a contentious election that sparked protests and violence. For analysis of Bolivia's tumultuous year in politics, I reached out to Renata Segura, Deputy Director of Latin America and the Caribbean for the International Crisis Group. First, Renata, can you give us an overview of what's taken place over the last year in Bolivia?
Sure. So essentially, Evo Morales ran for president again in 2019, really against constitutional mandates, and he had convene a referendum, which he lost, asking if these restrictions to re-election should be done with. And he ran despite the having lost on the referendum. He then packed the tribunal, the electoral tribunal, with supporters of him. And so he was able to run, right? So a lot of people who were not necessarily dissatisfied with his presidency and what he had managed to done seemed to walk away from the movement because of this kind of illegal way of trying to remain in power. After the whole debacle of last year, in which there were accusations of fraud, but also indications that Morales had been forced out of the country, the president, the interim president, was Jeanine Añez, and this interim government really unleashed a wave of harassment and persecution of the mass leadership and of the social movements that have traditionally supported their party. Sunday's vote was very much a rejection of the Añez administration and what many people in Bolivia see as an attempt by the white elite to undo a lot of the movement toward equality for indigenous people and the poor that the Morales administration had done.
After this tumultuous year, what does this election say about the state of Bolivia's democracy?
This was a very, very pleasant surprise. And I think a lot of us who are following closely the elections and the process of really extreme polarization and violence that have been happening during the last year, we're very pleased to see that the Bolivian democracy seems so much stronger than what we were expecting. I think that the fact that the transition was done peacefully, that the other candidates conceded despite the official count not being out, and more importantly, that the MAS as a political party seems to be very popular regardless of the standing of Evo Morales, seems all very good indications that the Bolivian democracy is much stronger than what last year's debacle sort of hinted that it was. But at the end of the day, it seems that the entire process was done fairly without violence and really showing the strength of the Bolivian institutions.
What about Arce? What might Bolivians expect from him as president?
So Arce is used to be Morales, a minister of finance and economics, and he is somebody who is a little bit of a different sort of political animal than what Morales is, because he's not a product of the social movement that launched Morales into the public scene. Rather, he's somebody who's much more technocratic. He was educated in the UK. He has been presented as a technical candidate. Granted, when he was Minister of Finance, he did a great job. People really liked him. But the economic situation in Bolivia was very different, right? There was a boom of commodity prices. Bolivia was receiving much more income for lithium and other products that they produce. And right now, he's coming into a fairly different context and situation with COVID, a very serious economic crisis, etc. But I think he differs from Morales also in that he's much more conciliatory. His first conversation with the press on Sunday, he struck a very conciliatory tone. He said that the MAS has learned from their lessons, their mistakes. And so it seems that really Arce is going to come as the head of this progressive leftist movement, but absolutely not replicating the kind of dynamics that was very confrontational that characterized Evo's administration.
What are the implications of this election more broadly on South America's political landscape?
Clearly, the Sunday results show that it continues to be a diverse continent where the left has done very important advances in some countries, and the citizens are not ready to really embrace the neoliberal discourse that some other countries have. I think it is going to be particularly challenging for the Organization of American States, definitely for the United States, which, like a more homogeneous region that really is aligned with the Washington mandate. This shows that Argentina, obviously Venezuela and Nicaragua remain, but Bolivia is firmly rooted on the left paradigm right now, and that the results that these governments have had really is unlikely to move them to the right again in the near term.
That was Renata Segura, Deputy Director of Latin America and the Caribbean for the International Crisis Group. In the U.S., the debate over how to vote by mail has become a key issue for the upcoming election, particularly in closely contested states like Pennsylvania. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled Monday that it will allow the state of Pennsylvania to continue counting ballots after the November 3rd election. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
The U.S. Supreme Court will allow the state of Pennsylvania to continue counting ballots after the November 3rd election. The chairwoman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party is calling this a significant victory for voters after accusing Republicans of trying to sow confusion and disenfranchise voters. On a divided 4-4 vote, the nation's highest court upheld a ruling that allows Pennsylvania to invoke an emergency provision for extending the voting deadline by 3 days, with the virus pandemic creating a surge in mail-in ballots and the Postal Service delays. Only ballots that were mailed after the polls close on November 3rd would be rejected. Republicans say the new deadline violates federal law that defines Election Day. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Also on the election, there are new rules for the second and final debate later this week between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. AP's Mike Gracia has that story.
President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden will each be allowed to make uninterrupted remarks for 2 minutes per topic in Thursday night's final presidential debate. The Nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates says the microphone for the candidate who is not supposed to be speaking will be muted during the 2 minutes that are allowed for opening remarks on each debate topic. The Trump campaign had pressured the commission to avoid changing the rules, but the Biden campaign wanted a more ordered format, hoping to avoid a repeat of the September 29th free-for-all.
Sir, it's just a wrong statement.
Yeah, I understand. You've agreed to the 2 minutes, so please let him have it.
Do I get my time back?
Mike Gracia, Washington.
This is VOA. Russia on Tuesday said it was ready to offer the United States a mutual one-year freeze on the number of nuclear warheads held by both countries. The offer, if accepted, could pave the way to extend the landmark New START arms reduction deal. The New START went into effect in 2011, but expires next February. Last week, Russian President Vladimir Putin proposed extending New START by 1 year, but the White House said it would not agree unless there was a freeze on the number of nuclear warheads as well. The U.S. Justice Department joined 11 states Tuesday in filing an antitrust lawsuit against Alphabet Inc.'s Google for allegedly breaking the law in using its market power to hamper its rivals. Google's search engine is one of the most used in the world, and the company had revenue of $162 billion in 2019. The company's range of products, including mapping, entertainment, and smart speakers, have raised privacy concerns because of the amount of data it collects on its users. The suit follows years of complaints by Google's competitors and by governments. Last year, the European Union fined Google $1.7 billion for stopping websites from using Google's rivals to find advertisers. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Last week, the United States Food and Drug Administration approved a new Ebola treatment called Inmazeb, made by the company Regeneron. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar hailed the drug as a, quote, momentous global health achievement, end quote, which could help African countries fight Ebola outbreaks. Ongoing Ebola outbreak in Western Democratic Republic of Congo has killed over 50 people since May. To find out more about the new drug, I reached out to emergency physician and epidemiologist Armand Sprecher, who has helped respond to Ebola outbreaks with the medical aid group MSF, or Doctors Without Borders. Armand, how does this drug work to fight Ebola?
I guess the simplest way to think about it was, if you got Ebola and survived, what would get you through your infection would be your immune system. A large part of that, especially towards the end of illness, would be a response based on antibodies that your body made to fight off the infection. This product is essentially antibodies similar to the ones that you would have made on your own. So these antibodies would provide your body with a similar immune response, something that would fight off infection, ideally before you got ill.
And how effective does this treatment appear to be?
The best indication we have is from a study that was done in the Democratic Republic of the Congo during the, not current, but previous outbreak in the eastern DRC. They did a study on somewhere around between 700 and 800 patients, a quarter of whom roughly received this treatment. The mortality in this group, the proportion of people who died, was somewhere between 30 and 35%, whereas people treated with other therapeutic agents, for example, those who got ZMapp or remdesivir, which is in the news a lot now, their mortality, the proportion of people that died, was sort of in the 50% range. So we know that this drug is more effective than other therapeutics that we've tried.
And how safe is this treatment? Any serious side effects?
It appears rather safe. It does not appear that the patients who received this drug had any downstream problems that weren't mostly consistent with just their having Ebola virus. Where MSF was delivering the drugs, because we participated in the trials that developed the evidence for this drug, none of the reports that I saw were consistent with a adverse effect from the drug.
Now, there have been some accusations recently of politicization of the FDA's approval process in relation to COVID-19 treatments. Do you have any concerns about the approval process for this Ebola treatment?
No, I don't. The clinical trial on which this drug's approval is based was done back in the 2018-2019 outbreak in North Kivu and Ituri. So that was well before we were becoming alarmed about potential manipulation of the approval process. So the drug has demonstrated its safety and efficacy in advance of our current concerns. And the administrative procedures to gain approval were started well before. And this has been in the works for some time. And the announcement of the approval now comes as no surprise. So I don't feel like this was unduly accelerated or is coming ahead of schedule.
And does MSF plan to administer this drug to treat Ebola?
Yeah, we have to make sure that it's available. So we are hoping it will be available for our use in the future. And to the extent that we can just buy it off the shelf, we're ready to do that.
Last of all, what impact will this treatment have on combating Ebola outbreaks, including the current outbreak in the DRC?
The absence of a therapeutic has always been a problem, because what you need to do to control outbreaks is to get people with the disease to come to a place where they can be cared for in an environment where their infection risk to others, healthcare staff, family, people in the community, is controlled. Their incentive for coming is rather meager when you don't have a therapeutic option to offer them. So it had always been our great hope that we would one day have a therapeutic agent that would provide a benefit to the patient to come to us. So this has been something we've been waiting for a long time. However, what we learned in that outbreak in North Kivu and Ituri was that this only works if people have confidence and trust in the healthcare agencies that are providing the therapeutic. So this is a great tool, or a tool with great potential, not only for saving lives, but for controlling outbreaks. But it will only work as a tool if people have confidence not only in the drug itself, but in the agencies that are making that drug available. And we have not yet perfected a way to win over mistrustful communities during these outbreaks, because the outbreaks themselves stir mistrust.
That was Armand Sprecher with Doctors Without Borders, MSF. As the Afghan Taliban tries to negotiate a political settlement with the government, many musicians in the country are worried about the impact a deal will have on their ability to work. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Kabul.
Musician Javed Karwani was at his regular artist hangout and workplace last month when some people approached him for a job. A wedding was taking place in one of the districts of Kabul province. It is part of Afghan culture to organize a musical evening during wedding celebrations. Khalakan district, close to Bagram Air Base, was long a secure area. But locals say recently, Taliban militants have become active at night. Parvani and his band took the job. He had performed in the area previously without a problem, but this time turned out to be different. Abdul Ghafoor is a resident of Kalakan. His son was in the musical party that night when the Taliban attacked.
He saw them at a march.
The party was in full swing when my son and his friends reached the venue. That's when they saw 20 to 30 armed Taliban with turbans on their heads and their faces covered surround the gathering. When people saw the Taliban, they ran.
Parvani and his band barely escaped, but the Taliban destroyed their instruments. Local elders were so scared, they refused to let the groom or his family talk to journalists.
This narrow dirt street leads to the garden where the musical evening was taking place. We tried to go there, but the local elders stopped us. Worried about their safety and the safety of their area, they do not want to talk about this incident.
Pictures of the destroyed instruments went viral on social media, scaring artists all over the country. Parvani said the incident made them feel unsafe, even in the capital, Kabul.
Allah guide them. Why shouldn't we be scared? If they did it there, they will do it here. When they run the government, they will not let us sing.
His thoughts are shared by many in the country. After 40 years of war, Afghans are almost unanimously vying for peace. But many in the artist community are scared that peace may come at the cost of their livelihood and their art. Meanwhile, threats from the Taliban have already reduced Parvani's business to a trickle. He hardly makes $250 a month. It will take his band almost 2 years to earn enough money to buy their musical instruments again. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Kabul.
That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the identification or location of Adnan Abu Walid al-Sarawi, also known as Walid. He is a key leader of the terrorist organization ISIS in the Greater Sahara, also known as ISIS-GS. This terrorist group emerged when Abu Walid and his followers parted from the al-Qaeda splinter group Amoura Batoun. ISIS-GS is based primarily in Mali, along the Mali-Niger border. It proclaimed its allegiance to ISIS in May 2015. Under Abu Walid's leadership, this terrorist group conducted a number of attacks, including the October 4, 2000 attack on a joint U.S.-Nigerian patrol in Niger, close to the Malian border, which resulted in the deaths of 4 U.S. soldiers and 4 Nigerian soldiers. On May 16, 2018, the U.S. Department of State designated Abu Walid a specially designated global terrorist pursuant to Executive Order 13224. At the same time, ISIS-GS was designated a foreign terrorist organization under Section 219 of the Immigration and Nationality Act. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Diplomatic Security Service. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $150 million to more than 100 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. If anyone has more information about Abu Walid al-Sarawi, please contact the Rewards for Justice website at www.rewardsforjustice.net, email info@rewardsforjustice.net, or contact the regional security officer at the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States.